And Lindsay, I see you joined. I want to introduce you to Mina, who's with Urban Faith. Michael should be right behind her.
Okay.
Okay, and just to, unfortunately, I have a hard, I could probably extend it until 3:40, but just have these 10 minutes here, apologize.
I'm gonna let Michael in here. No, you got it, Lindsay.
And Michael, I think, can stay a little longer.
Okay.
Yes.
Michael, are you there? There we go.
Yes, that's Michael.
Hey guys, good afternoon, Lindsay, Michael. Good to be with you both. I love the book. I'll go ahead and get started. Lindsay, I'm going to make sure to have you off here in time here. So I'll get some of the questions in with you up front, Lindsay. Okay, how do you write these books, Lindsay? That's the first question, because I feel lazy. Like, you're on the news every day. You have a big life going on. How do you do this?
Well, the very easy answer is Michael Tyler. Gotcha. He's the brain trust. We started working together on the last book, The Smallest Spot of a Dot. And that was something that had really been on my heart for a long time, that I wanted to do a story about the Human Genome Project. Hmm. But I couldn't figure out how to conceptualize it in a way that would be palatable for the youngest crowd. And the idea that, you know, our DNA is 99.9% alike. And so I just had a brainstorming session with Michael, and he immediately came up with the idea of spots or dots, you know? And so ever since then, I was like, all right, Michael, you're rolling with me, you know, we're doing the next book together as well. And so he has been my partner ever since. But you know what, the thing to me is that the kids' books for me have always been the fun part of what I do. I've always considered myself to be a storyteller. It's just that normally I'm talking about like murder and mayhem and missing and chaos. And so I didn't really always want my son to watch me doing the news, but he wanted to kind of see what mommy's doing. Yeah. So this to me was a way to share the good news. And in particular with my first book, The World is Awake, which was really an homage, just a love letter to God, just about his majesty and his creations, including us. I always feel like you make time for the things you're passionate about. Yeah. And so as far as like, you know, how do I have the time? It's a nice positive outlet. It's something that I want to do. But also I think that we make time for the things that we want to do.
Yeah. Why do you think kids resonate with your book? My daughter saw it and was like, oh, I got to read this. And she is 11. And so where does that come from?
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah. So why do they resonate with your books so well?
Well, I'm glad to hear that that is the case. You know, one thing I would say early on, because my son was really my muse, I would always use him as kind of the sample audience. So yeah. I would look at and study what he found interesting, intriguing in books, what really grabbed his attention, the books that he wanted to keep reading again and again. And I also kind of went into this, I always feel like whatever you do, you study the greats who did it before you, right? And so for me, everybody would have everybody would have a different opinion about who the greats are. But for me, it was Dr. Seuss and Shel Silverstein. Those were the book authors who I really loved as a child. And so I looked at, you know, what was really effective, what really grabbed my attention. And one of the things I thought was they all had great messaging. You know, there was meaning. They had great rhymes, but there was there. You know, it wasn't just like about popcorn and bubblegum for the sake of it. There were things that you could really take away. And that's what I'm hoping that children, it's kind of like candy coated medicine, you know, something that's good for you, but tastes good too. And goes down smooth. Wow. I think that's what I at least I'm aspiring for. And I hope that it is resonating with kids.
So you come with these ideas, do you call Michael up immediately and go, hey, I got another idea? How does that work?
Yeah, so Michael and I don't know, maybe we had like two or three phone calls. Michael, you could help me remember. for a small spot of a dot when we were coming up with that original idea. But I want to say it was within that first phone call that you came up with the dots. You correct me if I'm wrong. Do you remember how that happened?
Yeah, that is correct. Because I remember you calling me up after you had done a reading to a classroom of children. And I think it was, and you discussed the Human Genome Project with a classroom of children, and yes, how fascinated they were about it, and called me up and said, there's something here. We got to figure out how to get them to understand that. And for me, the lessons that I got in life that lasted the longest all came by way of metaphor. My mother was a metaphor magician. And so I always thought if you give somebody a physical model to keep in their mind, they will always be able to associate the lesson with it. Mm. And that genes and double helixes and things like that are far too complex for children to comprehend, far too complex for many adults
to understand. For me to comprehend.
Yeah, for me to comprehend.
Yeah. right. And so I figured, particularly when Lindsay and I wanted to focus on this one salient truth that came out of the Human Genome Project, and that is that 99.9% of all of our genes are alike, are identical, that only 0.1% is different, that accounts for our individual looks and individual distinction. And I am thinking, how do we show them how much that 99.9 is and how much that 0.1 is? And I could do that just by getting them to understand something that's already in their universal frame of reference, and that's spots and dots.
Yeah. Lindsay, can I ask this question? I know you got to go after this one. I'm talking to people all across America who are asking me, are we going to make it through this? And when I see you on in the morning times, sometimes when you're filling in, I always go, how does she do it? When there's so much bad news. So here's a simple question. Are we going to make it through this season? I mean, are we going to come out okay, remembering the 99% here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, to me, there's no benefit in being a pessimist, right? It goes back to one of my favorite quotes of Henry Ford, you know, whether you think you can or you can't do something, you're right. And so if we set out thinking, oh, boy, this is the end, then that is going to just be the beginning of the end for you personally, right? Yes. And so I'm always been a glass half full kind of a girl. I feel like whether it was Vietnam, whether it was, you know, the series in the 60s where you had, JFK, MLK, RFK assassinated. I'll bring up this quick point. I was fortunate enough to be able to do an event with Carol Simpson at the beginning of the year. And I was telling, we were talking to a class of journalists I teach at Franklin College in Indiana. And I was saying to her, and really they were asking questions, but I had a question for her. And that was about, are things as bad now as they were then? And she felt like, even though, yes, the world is on fire right now, it was so much worse in the 60s. That was her perspective. Yeah. And so the people then in the 60s, maybe they had that same mindset of, boy, how are we going to make it? Is this the end, right? But they're just like everything in life. It's cyclical. There are upturns and there are downturns, right? The leaves fall off, they dry up. But then in spring comes and the warm weather and the sunshine and they're back again anew, revitalized. And I just feel like that's my outlook on life. So even when things seem like, boy, it just can't get any worse, and somehow it still does, I think that we just have to have, and that's where I think that my faith comes in. You know, I mean, I just have to believe that as Jeremiah 29:11 says, like God has a plan, right? And it's for good, it's for hope. And I just kind of live by that. And I think to not have faith is when we would become so down and out and really feeling like, boy, this is just nothing good can come of this. I just choose to be optimistic and choose hope.
Well, I'm so glad that you're there to tell the news. And my nephew, Caleb, keeps saying to me, because I interviewed you a while back, and he said,
yeah,
have you interviewed her again recently? I said, no, but it's coming up. And he said, I wish I could marry her. And I'm thinking, there's a big problem here. I thought she might didn't like the news.
That is very sweet.
He's 14. So
well, tell Kate I said hello.
But he's not. It's really you. Lindsay, thank you for your time.
Tell him I said hello.
Michael, the hard questions for you and I next. Thank you, Lindsay. I appreciate
all right. I'll see you. And bye, Michael. Thank you.
You got it. Be good.
Thank you, Lindsay. All right, Michael, I got to ask this question, man. Where do you come up with these things? You take them and you, like, it seems like you take them to another level, man.
I really appreciate you saying that. I think part of it, a large part of it for me, is intrinsic. I think that everyone has a certain intrinsic trait, quality, ability that is their genius. For some people, we see them flying through the air and dunking basketballs. For some people, we hear virtuosity on a horn when I listen to John Coltrane. There's a genius there. And so for me, part of it was I had this ability that no matter what I looked at, I had to break it down to its least common denominator. Mm. But through the years, my brain was always trained to constantly breaking things down, analyzing things. And then that gave me the ability to do reverse order on it. How do I construct it? And as quickly as I could break it down, I was able to bring it back together again and have a different understanding of it. And my fascination with words was what really drove me to be able to do this with respect to writing. Because from as long as I can remember, 5 years old, I was always fascinated with how language came to be. Why do we even have words?
No, Michael, I'm sorry to cut you off. I got my question on my phone. So my wife is having me like get rid of paper, Michael. This is like great around here because I love paper. And so my question on the phone here. And so one of my questions is, where do you get these words from, man?
That I ended up writing?
Yeah. Because they're for children. Children's books are hard, Michael. They're not easy, man. Where's that come from?
It's really, you hit it on the head. It's really not easy. The hardest audience to write for me are children, because you have the fewest amount of words that you have to work with.
Yeah.
And I think what enabled me is early on in life, when other people were second, third, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade reading books, I was reading dictionaries. Because I looked at dictionaries as a way that people look at crayons. And to me, crayons allow you to draw a beautiful picture. And to me, words allow you to speak a beautiful picture. And I always wanted to be able to create the best image possible about what was in my head by using my mouth. And that meant that I had to paint with words. I had to draw with words. I couldn't do it with temper paints. I couldn't do it with finger paints. I couldn't do it with crayons. And so instead of having that 8 crayon box, I was always trying to get that 148 crayon box. And that's what's in my head.
So it started for you early.
Very early.
When did you know that you had the gift, though, Michael? Like, when did you know, I think I got this?
That's an interesting question. I think I was 8 years old when it first came to me. I read a book called The Little Prince. Wow. And it's a book that I would recommend everyone read. Ever since I was 8 years old, and to this day, I'm 63. So we're talking about 55 years. Ever since I was 8 years old, I've read that book at least once a year. Hmm. And it is, it forms a cornerstone in my ethos about how I live. And after I read that book, and I read that book 4 days before Martin Luther King was assassinated. And I say that because one of the messages in the book is that what is only visible to the heart will always be invisible to the eyes.
Hmm.
Okay. And King was talking about that in everything that he dealt with, the content of character. The heart sees character. The eyes see corporal, they see body. And after I read that book, and that message was so timely to King's death and everything that King stood for, I said to myself that one day I want to write a book for a child that would make that child feel the way I felt when I read this book. And that started me thinking about how I might one day become a writer. And I had all these words. I tell anybody who wants to become a writer, learn as many words as you can, because when you say, where do I get these words from? I have a big inventory. So when it comes time for me to write, I just access the inventory and they're there.
So do you enjoy, I would ask this question, you know, I write as well, Michael, not like you, but what do you enjoy about writing though, man? Because it takes me a while to get to the desk sometimes, man. how do you make it happen?
For me, it's something that's a great question. It's because I can give you the mechanics of it. But for me, it really boils down to one thing. Writing to me is so essential and elemental to who I am that it's like breathing. And so to me, the question would be like me asking you, why do you breathe? It's that fundamental to me. Writing is something that I'm so compelled to do that I cannot think not to do it. Mm. And so I'm constantly formulating idea and concept in my mind in written word. And I have this very strange thing. This is not something I'm bragging about because it's very strange. And I thought that everyone could do this. And it wasn't until I was 19 years old and somebody told me that I was a freak, that I didn't know that I was the only one to do this. Is I can literally write pages in my head and not write it down. And I can store it. And then I can go back to it later on. Just like you're putting stuff down on a computer. So I can walk up and down the street and write 3 or 4 pages and edit in my brain. And then 4 or 5 hours later or 4 or 5 days later, I can just go back and retrieve it and put it down. And so I realized that kind of gave me an advantage when it came to writing because I was able to conceptualize on a level that a lot of people aren't able to conceptualize for. So to me, that's part of the answer of how or why is because I have this conceptualization ability that I think that some people just don't have.
It's pretty remarkable. I've kind of followed you, stalked you the last couple of days, man. So I'm gonna leave it at that. So you don't go, do not do this interview ever again. I'm gonna go quick with these last three questions, man. When you get ready to partner with Lindsay on these books, is there like a prep time? Is there like a rhythm that you get into that, you know, makes you come out with these beautiful works, man?
Well, first of all, I appreciate you saying beautiful works, and I appreciate everything that you said about the book so far. It's a testament to the commitment and conviction that Lindsay and I have towards writing them. But there is. I mean, Lindsay and I have a good exchange when we have a creative brainstorm and we bounce off one another. There's a fluidity to it that makes it magical because of that, we don't have a stall in the ideation of things. Because a person can have an idea and then 3 months later, they get their first word about it.
It takes forever sometimes, yeah.
Exactly right. Whereas with me, I've always been fast to do things because I have all these chyrons running in my brain. They're going left and right. And so I can just reach down on one of the lines of my brain and snatch something and run with it. And Lindsay is, and if you read her books, this is one of the reasons why I think that Lindsay's books resonate so well with people, is that the only word I can use is there's a purity of message that she brings to her work. Mm. And when you take that purity of message and you're able to pair it with a person like me who can think things and come up with stuff really quickly, it gives us a flow and a convergence and a merger of ideas and creativity that seems to work for what we're producing in books.
And how do you get into the mind of a child, though? Like, it's one thing to write for, I mean, general public, for adults. That's hard, by the way. But jumping into the mind of a child is really, really tough.
It is tough. And I would say for me, how I was able to do it was when I first started thinking about writing children's books. I realized, for example, with picture books, you're writing for a 4 to 8 age group.
Yeah.
That the functioning vocabulary of a 4 to 8-year-old might be about 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 words.
Yeah.
And so I have to look at what words they're using and what words they're understanding and then try to figure out how are they thinking of the world and how are they responding to the world only using those words. Because the words that are accessible to adults to explain themselves and to understand are not accessible to them. So I have to eliminate all those words that adults may use to try to convey a concept like racism or sexism or pain or misery or depression. And I can only use the words that a child has in their vocabulary range. And it took me a couple of years to train myself to think that way, that I'm only thinking of these words that children who are 8 years old are using. And then I would sit at playgrounds and I would sit at parks and I would just listen to how children talk to each other and how children explain things to themselves, because that's what really taught me how to think like a child. It's not how, listen to how children respond to adults, but how do children actually respond and explain things to themselves? And that's how I picked it up.
I want to do these last two together. First, how did you and Lindsay meet? And then second, when you guys hit send on this project, it goes off to Zondervan. Did you say to yourselves, man, we did it all? Or did you go, we may have left some on the cutting floor?
I'll answer the second one first. Whenever Lindsay and I are finished with a manuscript, we always think it's a home run.
Then the editor calls. So I'm joking.
Fortunately, the editors have agreed that we've hit it out the park as well. But we always think that we've hit a home run. We don't send anything out unless we feel like we can round the bases. But in terms of how Lindsay and I met, I wrote a book with Jordan Gilman, a co-author, a book called Mirror Face. And it's a book that tries to teach children about self-love. They have a daily practice for self-love. And Jordan knew Lindsay. And we spoke to Lindsay in the process of us trying to get that book published. And that was how I met Lindsay. I met Lindsay because she was introduced to me by Jordan. And Lindsay and I had this kind of creative rapport right off the bat. And it didn't take long. I mean, it happened instantaneously with like the first word. And from that point on, we developed this kind of creative bond that lasted over a couple of years before she finally came out to me and said, I think we should do a project together. And that's how it came to be.
I got to tell you, I've been fascinated to Lindsay's great, don't get me wrong, but I've been fascinated just to read about you. And I literally walked away. I do executive producing for a company, for a streaming company called Right Now Media. And I told the producer there, I said, we need to talk to this guy about doing something on writing, telling stories for children, because you don't see it a lot, if that makes sense, Michael. And so yes. It's just fascinating to see. And I think you need to teach it more, man.
I am more than willing to do that. My hand is raised. Yes, call on me.
It's fascinating to me.
I appreciate you saying that. One thing I'd like to drop before we get off is you asked Lindsay, are we going to make it through? Yeah. Are we going to do this season?
I do wonder sometimes. Okay. She was optimistic about it.
She was optimistic. And she used the word hope. And I want to give a definition for that word, because oftentimes what I've learned in life is people use words and we don't fully understand what we're saying. That's why we have so much communication confusion. If you were asked a 50-year-old and a 5-year-old to define the word hope, both of them would struggle with it. If you asked them to define the word trust or truth, they would both struggle with it. And so one of my exercises in life growing up was always to write down my own definition for a word. And the way I describe hope, and I think it marries onto what Lindsay's optimism is, to me, hope is an emotional alignment to possibility.
Wow.
Where you see no possibility, you are hopeless. And hopelessness to me is the most dangerous thing to the human mind. That's what causes us to completely give up on everything. And so as long as you can align yourself to the possibility of something being better or something being more, or something being recovered, or something being redeemed, as long as you're going to align yourself to that possibility, even if it's a 1% chance, a 1% chance is 100% greater than no chance at all. And so I always try to align myself to the possibility of what humanity can excel to, because we've nowhere near gotten to that level. And there's a big margin for us to go ahead and move towards.
Wow. Michael, no, we got to go, man. I got the title. By the way, if you see that somewhere, the possibility. Let's just say I got the recording. I'll leave it right there for you. Oh, man.
Right on, man.
This never happened. I'm joking, sort of. So all I gotta say to you next is this, man. I got a title for your next book, man.
What's that?
The Power of Hello, man.
Oh.
I think there's such power to that word, man.
Tremendous power to that word.
That and we're not learning to connect well. There's a right. It's concerning to me that we're not.
Here's a power I see in that word. When I was a young kid, I used to play a game, and I would try to say hello with my eyes.
Wow.
Not my mouth, to get people to respond back to me. And I would count how many times people would acknowledge me just by me, not even smiling, not just saying mentally hello with my eyes. And what I came to understand the power in that, because there is a lot of power in hello, even if you don't say it, is that when we look at each other, think of plug and outlet. That's how we connect.
Yes.
If we're not even looking at each other, making that connection. The verbal hello is another way to make the connection, but you can say hello without looking at somebody and then not feel connected to you at all. So to me, it all starts with right here. I really like the idea of the power of hello. I'm going to have to give that one a lot of thought.
I'm serious, man. I've been holding on to those words. And when I read y'all's book or books here the last couple of days, I'm glad this interview got held up here because I had a chance to go back and read some of them myself. And I said, man, they really connect well with kids. So, and
I really appreciate you saying that.
Well, I will be in touch. Thank you, Michael. I'm fascinated by you and Lindsay both, but reading your stuff this time around I was a nerd. It was fascinating. It really was.
Much gratitude.
Thank you, man. Keep it up. I'll be in touch with you, man.
I appreciate that.
I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.